The poison of corporate-controlled information is pervasive within the American media landscape, which makes the Laura Flanders Show one of the most important places that we can go to understand how power works, the reality around us, and how to resist. This is Chris Hedges, and I listen to the Laura Flanders Show.
Go to patreon.com/theLF Show and become a member. Hi, I'm Laura, and this is the Laura Flanders Show, a TV and radio program that shines a light on the solutions of tomorrow today. We report on the people and movements driving systemic change from the worlds of politics, arts, and entrepreneurship. Welcome.
Thank you so much for joining us as we officially introduce the Medicare for All Act of 2021. Our 125-page Medicare for All bill lays out a detailed blueprint on how we can transform the healthcare system into one that finally guarantees healthcare to everyone as a human right. We are introducing the bill with even more co-sponsors than we had when we introduced it in the last Congress. Our movement is growing.
That was Representative Pramila Jayapal announcing the Medicare for All Act that was reintroduced into the U.S. House on March 17th with a record number of Democratic co-sponsors. But while the idea of a universal health care system has never been more popular, the relationship of Americans to the system they have now has never been more fraught. The COVID-19 pandemic brought things to a head, with over 500,000 dead from coronavirus alone, and healthcare workers pushed to the max. It's clear we need change, but what sort of change? Today, I'm going to talk with economist Dana Brown, who comes to us from the Democracy Collaborative, where she's director of the Next System Project. She argues that the United States already has a public, universal model that works. It's not perfect, but we don't have to import a system from someplace else. And we'll hear from two nurses who know intimately the pros and cons of the system we have now. Linda Ward-Smith is a Department of Veterans Affairs nurse and president of the American Federation of Government Employees, or AFGE, Local 1224, representing 3,000 nurses in Las Vegas. And Kelly Cabrera, an emergency room nurse at Jacoby, a public hospital in the Bronx, New York. She's a member and the lead bargainer for her unit of the New York State Nurses Association, or NYSNA.
So, this has been a rough year. I just want to hear from you. Kick things off. Kelly, your best moments of the last year and perhaps your least good moments?
For us as nurses, especially in New York, our best moments were when we came out and advocated for our safety and for the safety of our communities and our coworkers, and to see the outpouring of support from virtually everybody was really amazing at that time. And I think the worst of it was being able to see ahead of time how we thought this would play out because of our broken healthcare system. Obviously, we couldn't have imagined it would have been as bad as it was, but just seeing how all of our systems failed at the time and how, unfortunately, they still continue to fail.
What about you, Linda?
Pretty much the same across the globe. We just began fighting for things that we felt we should have already had, PPE, protective gear. So it was very stressful in the beginning.
Was there a best moment?
Best moment was coming together and just, pulling together. I think we just needed to feel each other and know that we were in this together. And I think emotionally, that's what helped us through the whole thing.
Well, one person who's done a lot of talking about being together and in this together is President Joe Biden. And I want to play a clip of how he talks about the changes to come to our healthcare system, specifically how he talks about Medicare for All. Here's the president.
I believe the plan I proposed, which is building on Obamacare and providing a public option that is available for anyone, significantly reducing the cost of getting into the exchanges. My plan costs $750 billion. Would immediately cover everybody in America, allow you to keep your private plan if you wanted it, if you wanted it.
So that's just a sense of sort of where our political discussion is right now. And we're actually not here to have a debate about Medicare for All. Because I suspect we would probably all be on the same page. But I am interested in what you make, Dana, of this discussion as it currently exists. Are we talking about the right things? Are we going far enough? And in a moment like this, are there even bigger changes we could be thinking of or starting to implement?
We're asking some of the right questions, but we need to be asking a lot of other questions, right? In this moment of extraordinary crisis that was a long time coming and isn't only the pandemic, but the crisis of systemic racism, which is in itself a public health emergency, the massive inequalities in access, not only to healthcare services because of insurance issues, but geographic issues. There are places where there simply are no providers of certain services. We're on the brink of something like 900 hospitals closing all over the country in both rural geographies and in urban areas. So I think we really have to ask questions about what are the healthcare and public health systems that we need to provide for everybody. I mean, we spend almost a fifth of our GDP on healthcare at this point in the richest country in the history of the world. And I guess my question is, if we were to start with imagining how might we use a fifth of our GDP if we wanted to maximize health and well-being in our society? I think the answers we'd get would be really different than just, you know, patching some holes here and there, putting a little bit more money into the existing non-system.
You've been out front and center, Kelly, asking for a whole lot of change based on your experience in a public hospital in the Bronx. What stands out? What's your number one demand, need, desire, observation based on what you've been through?
It is abundantly clear that we cannot remain in this trajectory. We can't continue to try to patch a broken system. I honestly believe we have to start all over again. We have to break down all the barriers that that our patients face to get care. Millions of people lost their employment, right? And now, but because of that, and because in America, your health insurance is oftentimes granted to you through your employment, I mean, we're looking at a situation where more and more people are likely to lose their health insurance. We see what the disparities were during COVID and continue to be now. And I think the right way to approach that is just to change everything from the ground up.
Now, it's interesting, Dana, in her writing, in your writing, Dana, you often contrast the private system with the public system. But as people will see in this panel, we have even more than one public system. We have public hospitals like the one that Kelly works in, and then we have the VA system like the one that you work in, Linda. You've actually worked in private hospitals before you came to the VA. What was the difference, and why did you decide to stay where you are for as long as you have?
The main difference I see is actually the way funding is done in the VA system as opposed to private sector. The money is distributed different. Priorities can be different, and you know, because our population is different. We're caring for veterans. So what are their priorities is what we mainly focus on. I do believe there's changes that we all can make in each healthcare system. The disparities are still there, regardless of what system you're in. Lack of staffing, funding, equipment, all those things we still deal with here. Just reshaping the focus on how those dollars are spent, I think would be a great start. We pay providers on how many people they see and how many, you know, patients they see and all the treatments that they can crank out, as opposed to measuring that quality of care and giving them the time to actually improve on outcomes. I think that is something that we really need to start thinking about.
I mean, COVID, did it change things? Because this was not a surgery-solved disease. This was a care treated disease. Did that change perhaps our thinking about who matters in hospitals?
Absolutely. I often say when it comes to the issue of staffing, people don't understand, unless you yourself are in healthcare, if you are a nurse, or if unfortunately you are a patient. I think that is the time when people come to realize that, oh my gosh, if we don't have enough nurses, like, I'm not getting my pain medicine on time. I'm not getting, you know, my treatment on time. And I think that became very, very apparent. And you know what Linda said, I agree with that wholeheartedly. So much of our healthcare right now is focused on metrics and reimbursements. And it is so easy to just see a person when you get sucked into that thought process to not see our patients as patients, you just start seeing them as numbers. How fast can we get them in and out? It doesn't matter if they return and maybe they didn't get the care that they needed, but they got out faster today. And we have to eliminate that thought process from our healthcare system entirely.
While I think we have seen a bit of a shift in people's attitude to government in the last few months, there's still a chorus of voices from the right saying what COVID revealed was how our public system doesn't work. Dana, as you think about the challenges, how do you advance an argument for the sort of even more radical change that you're talking about?
You know, first and foremost, anything that you divest from will not work, right? Anything you take money away from enough and strangle enough won't work. And we see that in public health. It's not that we don't have really smart people doing great work in the public health system in the United States. It's that we've divested from it from decades and divorced it entirely from the provision of care that people like Kelly and Linda do. And the real argument for more public sector involvement in healthcare is just that the priorities can be different. In health and healthcare in general, we should be thinking about how to prevent people from needing to see Linda and Kelly, right? Be happy to see you when I have to, when I break something, right? But the idea is to invest in primary care and mental health services and community care, in the public health stuff that, like good jobs and housing and sanitation, that make conditions better so that fewer people, and so that systemically we're more on equal footing and we end up in the hospital less. The logic of what you can monetize and what is, you know, you can pay for and what you can get a return on has seeped into so much of all of the bits of healthcare system that we have out there, such that even nonprofit hospitals are saying, well, we're doing fewer elective surgeries, so we have less money, so we're going to cut nursing and we're going to, you know, cut the hours of our ER staff and all these things that don't make any sense to anyone who knows about health, but only about people who know about finance. We need to learn that we can divorce those two and that it might actually work out for the benefit of all of us.
I also have to point out that I do think things would be different if we weren't dealing with a nursing corps that was primarily women of color and immigrants. We might see some more power in their hands. As it is, unions make a difference. And here's a great clip of Kelly Cabrera preparing to address a rally for what nurses need in the public healthcare system in New York. This was shot in 2020, I believe on our own iPhone, for a special produced by the New York Times and FX, currently available, I think, on Hulu. Take a look.
I have my mask from today.
We've officially started doing the one mask a week. There's gonna be germs on the outside of my mask. And no matter how often I wash my hands, like by virtue of taking it off and putting it back on and taking, like, there will be some transmission where that is going to get on my face somewhere. And it just makes it that much more risky. Like, that's just the truth. We need to make a statement collectively asking the powers that be that have the stuff, that have the supplies, that have the capabilities of providing us the stuff and the supplies and the resources to act quick. We want to get through this whole thing as safely as possible, and all of us just are out here asking the government for help.
That's awesome. That's super good. That's a great statement.
Throw up. Nurses here at Jacoby Medical Center just held a press conference. They say the hospital is putting their lives at risk.
The masks are supposed to be one-time use. The ventilators, the PPE, the IV pumps, we need them now. We needed them before. And it's unacceptable.
On Monday night, I spoke to my dad for a really long time. He said, when you know something, don't doubt it. Don't ever doubt in doing it. This feels like the right thing to do. Speaking out feels like the right thing to do.
This is the Laura Flanders Show. I'm Laura. I'm here with two nurses, Kelly Cabrera and Linda Ward-Smith. Both have firsthand knowledge of the pros and cons of the healthcare systems we have now, and they serve in leadership roles advocating for their fellow nurses within their unions. Kelly Cabrera, whom you just heard featured in that clip in the New York Times' documentary They Get Brave, is a lead bargainer for her unit of the New York State Nurses Association, as well as being an emergency room nurse at Jacoby Hospital
Hospital in the Bronx. Linda Ward-Smith is president of the AFG Local 1224, that's in Las Vegas, and works at a Department of Veterans Affairs hospital. My third guest is the director of the Next System Project, economist Dana Brown. She's an active member of the U.S. Access to Medicines movement, and she's author of Medicine for All, the case for a public option in the pharmaceutical industry. We're discussing healthcare in the U.S. after COVID-19. What's next and how could it be better? You know, you can watch this episode and see my interview with Dana from a year ago about public pharma at our website, lauraflanders.org. Just check out our Forward Thinking on COVID-19 series. While you're there, be sure to sign up for our newsletter and get updates on all our web exclusives, like the F word, my regular commentary. This week's is on our culture of violence. Couldn't we pick a different one? Next, I ask my panel, after the last year on the front lines being praised, were they listened to? And where are we now when it comes to listening to nurses and what they think should happen to change our healthcare system for the better? What would be different? But first, here's America's Real Pandemic by Mickey Affleck, featuring Janine Sugar Lyons, courtesy of Soul Sun Soul Music.
Let's talk about the real pandemic of America. And they are the carriers of injustice and prejudice for over 400 years. And there is no cure for their contagion. There is no vaccine for this obscene treatment of our people. I can't breathe.
Where are we in listening to nurses? And what would our healthcare system look like if we did? If we designed it according to your values, Kelly, what would be different?
We would put an emphasis on actually improving our patients' health. And that, unfortunately, the way our system is set up now, that is not where the emphasis is. Our priorities are completely backwards. To what Dana was saying before, that was brilliant. It's this idea that, you know, if we make our society healthier, we're not gonna need to depend on our hospitals to fix society's problems. And this is something that we see that is so prevalent, especially in the emergency room. We have such a shortage of primary care providers in this country. Why? The reimbursement rates for these doctors are so low. There's no incentive for doctors who get into so much debt through medical school to go through that. So there's so many less of them. There's less access to care. So now patients end up using the emergency room as their primary care, which is unfortunately the way healthcare has been set up, that this narrative forms. It's almost like we blame our patients, like, why are you coming here for something so small? And it is truly and honestly not their fault. We've just created a system that is so broken, it doesn't work for them.
Linda, you've been wanting to jump in here. Go for it.
You know, just thinking about what the healthcare system would look like if it was nurse ran, you know, we would focus more on prevention, right? Because we as nurses are caretakers, we're nurturers. We care about the whole body, right? So in knowing that, we will focus on prevention instead of this disease chasing kind of a mode. And just worrying about the bottom dollar. Well, the bottom dollar would correct itself if we correct the issues that our population have. So definitely, I think we would be able to run it better.
I thought you might say that. Dana, what about you?
Well, I love what Linda was saying. I mean, my question is, what would our healthcare system look like if it were a system, right? And I know it's not perfect, but one advantage that the VA has or that the British NHS has is that it is more of a system and it's more integrated. As a patient, I have a chronic degenerative disease. I have 9 specialists and none of them have ever talked to one another, and I cannot pay them to talk to one another. That's an advantage that the VA has, where, you know, a veteran can show up in Idaho one day and move to an island in Hawaii the next, and all the records are there and all the specialists talk to one another. And I guess the question is, like, can't that be our starting point for what we ask for everybody?
Talk a little bit more, Linda, about how the VA is perhaps worthy of a little more attention and another look. I mean, you stayed there partly because of what Dana described, the security.
Definitely. We're always on the cutting edge of new research, new innovation within the VA system. And I think it is a system that we should tap into to kind of model. Your patients show up and, you know, they're going to all these different healthcare systems and nobody knows really what's going on with them. And so that also can increase the, the negative outcomes that we have because we're not keeping up with their whole body, whole healthcare, like we should. That is one good thing that the VA does well is we do communicate with other healthcare systems and we're growing because we have new systems that we're putting in place to make it even better. So definitely that would help.
One other thing to point out real quickly is that, you know, while the private sector and even many nonprofit hospitals and healthcare systems around the country have fired or furloughed staff or shut down facilities during the pandemic, the VA has been accepting non-veteran patients. They've been sending their staff all over the country to 49 states and territories, last I checked, to support public health programs, vaccination, delivering PPE. There's just a real difference here in what the logic is, the defining logic of these systems.
In the Bronx there, Kelly, you know, you were up against it. Huge patient load, not a well-resourced community. I'm imagining you might also be facing cuts now. What are you hearing and what do you fear about this continuing imbalance?
It's really disheartening. It's such a stark contrast to what people were saying to us all last year, right? You're heroes. You guys are heroes. They're clapping for us. And then to see the proposed budget in New York for New York City, I think from the way it's written out now, we're seeing about $500 million to be cut from the public system. And this is the largest public hospital system in the country and what that means for our community. Does that mean that we're not gonna open any more clinics where we're supposed to be opening these things called express care in New York City for all the public hospital systems? Do these cuts mean that they're just that will just not happen anymore? I would imagine there would be clinic hours would be reduced, a shortage of staff, all of these things which will always just harm our patients. And then later on down the line, it will be inevitable that we'll be told, oh, the public system is inefficient. Because that's always the way it plays out. They starve you of resources, and then they say that you're inefficient for what? So we can privatize? And obviously that is not the answer. The answer is at this time where we're depending so much on the public system, we should be investing in the public system.
Is it as simple as not letting the market do what markets do, Dana? Because that's kind of what we've been doing up to now, even inside the public system.
If we think of healthcare as a public utility or a right rather than, you know, a service that you can buy, then the calculus changes because the positive externalities of having a healthy population, right? People can stay in the workforce, they can go to school, they can participate in their community, right? But we're cutting everybody off at the knees by saying, well, it's your responsibility as an individual, it's your responsibility as an underfunded hospital and staff to like fix things once everybody's sick, right? But if we think of this as a public utility, as a service, right, that is just something that's part of life, you subsidize it like you subsidize public transportation because it has positive benefits for the economy, for local businesses, for people.
Well, I'm going to start a new practice in this season of the show by asking people what it is that gives them the faith or the belief or the experience, perhaps, that things actually can change for the better. Has there been a moment in your life, a person or an experience or a place or something you glimpsed that has given you this faith?
Through COVID, it brought out the person and people, you know, we connected in a way that I don't think we've ever connected before. Even in all of the midst of the bad, it brought out some good. So I'm hopeful, you know, we've been exposed, right? Our weakness, and I'm just hoping and praying that with that, we will get that change that we want to see in our healthcare system.
Kelly, clearly something put a fire in your belly.
It gives me hope when I see other people start making that connection. And when I hear people finally start saying, you know, the bad things out loud, I have hope that we can move forward from this. It's just going to take a lot of work and a lot of organizing, but I hope that that we'll be able to get there.
What's next for you, Dana, as you think about a next system for healthcare?
to keep working with people like you and Kelly and Linda and learning. But more than anything, I think to continue to encourage all of us to make our demands as big and bold as the needs that are out there. I mean, I think, you know, the multiple crises that we're continuing to live through, both in terms of health and the economy and structural racism, show us that there's a lot of work to be done. But therefore, I think our collective demands and our collective imagination about what could be just needs to go really beyond, like, you know, filling in this year's budget or, you know, getting us the PPE we need. Yeah, all of those things are necessary. But I think we have to demand the structural change that would kind of naturally deliver better outcomes. If we asked for more, we could get it. It's imminently doable to have a more coherent and more people-centered healthcare system. So we just got to keep asking.
I appreciate you all. Thanks for being with us. Dana Brown from the Democracy Collaborative's Next Systems Project, Kelly Cabrera from the Bronx Jacoby Hospital and NYSNA, the New York State Nurses Association, and from Las Vegas, Nevada, Linda Ward-Smith. We really appreciate all of the work you've all been doing. We'll be back with more in just a bit. We've been exposed. I love that line from Linda Ward-Smith on today's program. We have been exposed. While 2020 may go down in history as the year of the great shutdown, in many ways it was a year that opened us up, opened our eyes to our strengths and weaknesses as a society. It's been a year we've been exposed to the importance of our essential workers, especially nurses, which is why, when it comes to rolling out the vaccine, governors across this country brought in nurses to receive those vaccine shots first. In New York, it was Sandra Lindsay, a Queens, New York nurse, who said she volunteered to get the first shot in the state and in the nation because she wanted to instill in the public a sense of confidence. And that's what nurses do. When it comes to public trust and confidence, nurses rank number one. So I'm concerned that since December, I've barely seen a nurse in the mainstream news. I've barely heard what they have to say on the subject of what happens next. Now our news around COVID is all about pharmaceuticals and pharmaceutical corporations and statistics. Who's gotten the shot and who is left? We need to be listening to nurses now more than ever. What have they learned in the last year of the pandemic about what we need to change as a society and in our systems of public health? So, mask up, but mask your mouth, not your ears. Let's listen to nurses. Let's get healthy. For more information on all my guests, along with a whole lot of suggested reading, watching, and listening on the subject of how one might build a better healthcare system, one centered on care over profits, go to patreon.com/theLF Show. That's patreon.com/theLF Show, and pony up a few bucks to become a supporting subscriber. By doing so, you make it possible for us to get these conversations out to everyone through non-commercial, advertising-free television and radio stations and this free podcast. Journalism is the fourth estate, and it's vital in keeping a check and balance on our government and corporations, which is why our hackles go up at how much pharmaceutical advertising is on our cable news networks. We don't take funding from government or corporations or big pharma either. It's listeners like you we depend on and who we're happy to serve. It's your membership dollars that make it possible for us to continue this work. So thank you for what you've given. Please pony up your support if you haven't. You can find out more at patreon.com/theLF Show. Sign up today. This show is produced by yours truly, Laura Flanders, Matt Colicello, Jeremiah Cothran, Mercedes Grostiaga, Jeannie Hopper, Nat Needham, David Newman, Rory O'Connor, Charlotte Prager, Ryan Hotz, and Sabrina Artell. Major funding for this program is provided by the Novo, Tomcat, Cloud Mountain, Fonda, Park, Shift Tides, and the Poss Family Foundation, as well as listeners like you. Thanks for listening. Thanks for contributing. Thanks for your ideas. Stay kind. Stay curious. Till the next time, I'm Laura.